and Lake Geneva. Coming up on 10 Minutes After 8, the Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have a very special treat for fans of the TV series Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which, of course, will go down in history probably as one of the most ferociously popular television series of all time, with a fan base that is particularly devoted to this groundbreaking program. And among the greatest, most fervent fans of this show is Evan Ross Katz, who is a writer, columnist, podcast host, and someone whose work has appeared in all kinds of places, including New York Magazine, GQ, Rolling Stone, and many, many other places. He hosts currently a podcast called Shut Up, Evan, and he has written extensively about this television program and especially its beautiful star, Sarah Michelle Gellar. Evan Ross Katz has just given the world a really interesting book called Into Every Generation, a Slayer is Born, How Buffy Staked Our Hearts, a really illuminating examination of the phenomenon that surrounds this television program, and also some of the controversy that has dogged the creator of this program, Joss Whedon. And the book is published by Hachette, and I'm so excited to speak with Evan Ross Katz about his book, again titled Into Every Generation, A Slayer is Born, How Buffy Staked Our Hearts. Evan Ross Katz, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited to speak with you. I should think that there's something kind of exciting and also intimidating about trying to sort of gather up and focus and put onto the page your thoughts and feelings and to give some sort of capsule chronicle of this amazing series that you love so much. What has the experience been like for you to put this book together?
Yeah, that was certainly a challenge in that I knew I wanted to do an oral history. We just had the 25th anniversary of the series debut, so I knew there was reason to sort of, you know, pause and look back at the legacy of the show and speak with the actors. But I also wanted to sort of bring in my own experience with this show, my thoughts around it, my evolving thoughts on the show. So part of my task was sort of to weave together this as being part oral history, but part critical analysis, but part fan love of the show. Like, I wanted to function as both journalist and fan and memoirist and sort of bring that all together and have it be something cohesive. So I think the challenge for me was always less about the interviews themselves or compiling the gathering the information, and more about how to compile it and where to all lay it out. And that proved to be a challenge, but a fun challenge.
One of the things that's interesting about your love of this series is that your love does not translate the way sometimes love translates, where somebody loves a series and they love everything about it and they are not really interested in being critical about it or examining maybe its shortcomings or missteps. And you love this series incredibly, but you also love it in a way that allows you to look at it closely. I think at one point you say, "For me to love Buffy is to both contextualize and re-examine it." Tell us a little more about the nature of your love and devotion of this series and how it does not necessarily mean that you love every single thing about it or every moment of this series and its seven seasons.
Yeah, I mean, I think from the outset of when I first watched the show, I was, you know, a preteen when I first watched it. So I'm not sure I was completely picking up on everything that was going on so much as just, you know, some of the broader themes. And I've revisited it throughout junctures of my life. So in my teen years, again in college and into adulthood, always sort of picking up new aspects of the show. And yeah, there are some things about the show that I think hold up remarkably well. And others less so, and then add on top of all of that sort of the recent allegations that have come out about the show's creator over the last, I would say, 5 years at this point. There's been sort of a smattering of them. All of that sort of contextualizes the way I look at the show now. And then adding even on top of that, talking to some of the actors about their experience on this show, less than great experiences that they had on this show, that I watch certain scenes now, knowing what I know now, and I can see some of the sadness in certain actors' eyes or a lack of willingness to do a certain thing that they might have been asked to do that they didn't want to do. So I think I just have an evolving, I say evolving because I think it's very present tense, way in which I see the show. And like you said, it's like I very much love this show. But I think part of loving something as deeply as I have this show and for as long as I have this show means that you revisit it at certain times and your perspective shifts.
Before we go any further, I want to have you give, I'm afraid it has to be a very brief summary of this program, because it's entirely possible, it's actually, I think, probable that we have some people listening to this interview that have never watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And it would be probably helpful for where we go from here for them to have at least a general sense of what this series was just about on its most basic level, and maybe just a brief word, too, about what made it so groundbreaking, what made it so different from any other series that had come before it.
Definitely. So Buffy first was a movie in 1992. It featured Donald Sutherland, Rutger Hauer, Paul Rubin, Hilary Swank was in it. There's a cameo by Ben Affleck, you know, so a big cast from the movie, and it ultimately did not catch on. So 5 years later, in 1997, the creator of the movie took the concept to television and tried to adapt it. The concept is basically examining, you know, there's that blonde girl that's a part of a lot of 70s and 80s horror movies that dies an untimely death early on in the film. And the creator of Buffy said, you know, what happens if that character not only survives, but actually goes on to defeat the bad guy, actually has a power over the bad guy? And that became the premise for Buffy. And I think part of the reason why it resonated both then and now and became this pop culture phenomenon was you didn't have a lot of teen shows that really depicted teens with a lot of integrity and with a lot of self-possession. You know, this show didn't look down on teenhood. It actually respected teenagers as being young adults, sort of, you know, coming into their own, understanding who they are, growing, changing, learning. And so I think there was a respect that Buffy had for the experience of being a teen that television at that time did not really depict.
Hmm. By the way, when I read about the movie, which actually I have never seen, I have a feeling there's quite a few people who've never seen the movie you were just talking about. I'm reminded of something that the film critic Gene Siskel said once on his program, which is that, in his opinion, Hollywood makes such a bad mistake, and it makes it over and over and over again, of remaking things that were already good and don't need to be remade. And he said, you know, it would make so much more sense for Hollywood to take up a film that didn't quite work and try to do it better. And that's just not the way Hollywood works. But in this instance, I mean, not that the film was an utter failure, but by no means was it a blockbuster success. But this seems to be one of those relatively rare instances in which something that did not achieve huge success was nevertheless taken up and given sort of a second lease on life.
And it's odd because there really isn't a lot of reason why that was the case. I mean, like I said, the movie did not do well, but I think it really had a lot to do with timing. The network that Buffy premiered on was called the WB. It no longer exists today. But at that time, it was a fledgling network. It was very, very new. They didn't have much content outside of, they had a show called Seventh Heaven, which was beginning to hit for them. But this was before Dawson's Creek, before Charmed, before Gossip Girl. They didn't really have a signature show. And so when Buffy came out and started to gain some traction, it not only did that for the show itself, but also for the network. It really helped them to build out a whole roster of shows that Buffy was really the first of. And so I think had Buffy gone on an ABC or a CBS, I don't know if it would have had the impact it had that it did, becoming sort of like the marquee show at a new network.
Hmm. By the way, I love one phrase when you talk about the film, when you say it can be difficult to dissect something that middles, meaning that we tend to talk more easily and fluently about something that's a catastrophe like Ishtar or something that is, you know, the greatest thing ever. But something that's pretty good, sort of interesting, not great, not bad, kind of right in the middle. We just, not only does that often just sort of escape our notice altogether, but also just kind of talking about it is a little bit complicated and cumbersome. And I really appreciate the fact that you take the time to try to give us a thoughtful reaction to the film that started it all.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think that there's a tendency, and I think increasingly so in our culture, to either love something with intense passion or detest something. And I am always really fascinated by something that kind of exists outside of that, that people have strong feelings about, but those feelings are not necessarily like or dislike. Those are two words I'm not particularly concerned with. And in my research with the movie, it has a tendency to be written about as a flop film. And it wasn't a flop. It just didn't do as well as they had hoped. But there's a lot of reason behind that. Death Becomes Her, the film starring Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn, happened to open that same weekend. And the film more than recouped its production costs, which in many ways could be seen as a success. A lot of films don't do that. So I really wanted to contextualize this and many other instances of a perception around something not being quite accurate with the necessary context.
We're speaking with Evan Ross Katz, and we're talking about his book, Into Every Generation, A Slayer is Born, How Buffy Staked Our Hearts. One of the things you say, I think, both about the film and certainly the television series that sprang from it, is that Buffy overturns the typical paradigm for vampire stories. What is that essential overturning of the norms that we would typically have seen in vampire stories before Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
I think there was a way in which vampires were sort of perceived as creepy. They were night crawlers. They didn't exist within the, you know, within the world that we live in. They didn't have thoughts or feelings or wants or needs. And I think one of the things that Buffy did from the outset was say, yes, these are evil creatures. Yes, they feast on blood and they kill humans. I mean, they've got a lot of bad things that they do. And they have emotions and wants and needs and an interior life, and they can fall in love and they can have desires outside of the kill. So I think that it's sort of, and this has become something, you know, you look at the television landscape in the time since, this has become quite common. But at the time, I think it was less common to sort of take a, you know, I think it's, we've come to call it the anti-hero. I think Breaking Bad and The Sopranos broke a lot of ground in this genre. But again, Buffy was before all of that in sort of saying, yes, you can have characters who have innately bad desires, but also have good qualities within them that sort of texture who they are.
Hmm. I like how you characterize this notion of Buffy going from this first film to a television series as undoing the world of the film. And you actually take us pretty methodically through all of the different changes that were made. I mean, like the Buffy becomes, goes from a senior in high school to a sophomore in high school, and the location is changed, and other things are changed. You also tell us that Sarah Michelle Gellar, who ultimately, of course, becomes Buffy, was initially signed in that pilot episode for another role altogether and almost wasn't Buffy at all. Explain that really interesting turn of events.
Yeah, well, Sarah Michelle Gellar had been cast originally as Cordelia, which is definitely, it was a co-star on the show, but definitely the smallest part amongst the main cast. And they still had not found Buffy. They had brought in Katie Holmes, they had brought in Selma Blair, but they still hadn't quite landed on the series lead. And as you know, finding a series lead is very important. So they offered Sarah Michelle Gellar the opportunity to audition for the part. And so she did that. They called her back in and back in and back in, you know, to meet with network executives and to do chemistry tests, et cetera. And she got to the point where she was so exhausted by the process that she said, you know what? I'll be Cordelia. I'm completely satisfied with that. I just want this process to be over. And it was at that moment that they called her in and said, congratulations, you're Buffy. So there's a world in which, had they not said that, had they said, oh, you know, just one more round, she would have just been like, you know what, it's not worth it. But thankfully, the timing happened as it did, and that's the moment that she finally got the part, and she went on to become our great and legendary Buffy.
Hmm. As you talk about this character and what makes her so striking and really unique, one of the things you underline for us is something that you call a paradox, that the character of Buffy's humanity was both her secret weapon and her Achilles heel. Tell us more about that essential paradox about Buffy.
One of the interesting things about the show is there's sort of the lore of the Slayer. And you know, the Slayer, there's lore that exists outside of Buffy, even before Buffy, about, you know, who and what a Slayer is. But one thing within the world of the show is that Slayers predate Buffy. There's always a chosen one who is called upon to fight vampires, always a young girl. And one of the interesting things that the character of Buffy did to sort of subvert Slayers that before her was that she was much more of the world. In the forms before her, a Slayer's only task in life was to hunt vampires. But Buffy was a young girl. She had school to attend. She had a mother. She had friends. She had relationships. She had things that tethered her to life outside of just killing vampires. And so the paradox that I speak of is sort of this idea that those friends, those loved ones, are often the things that got her into danger, you know, through things that they would get themselves into. She had to save them time and time again. However, without them, had she not had them, she wouldn't have the same connections to the world and the reason to keep fighting. It's like the things that caused her so much strife so often, her loved ones, are the very reason why she kept the fight up. So I really like that dichotomy.
Hmm. One of the things your book does, and I'm sure for devoted fans of the series, they will really enjoy this, is that you take the reader step by step through the various seasons of the show. And really chronicle kind of the ups and downs of this series, which was always popular. I mean, and you know, really right up to the very end. But in a sense, it was not always, in a sense, maybe firing on all cylinders. Or I mean, kind of choose your metaphor. But it was not a steady ride. There was certainly some, let's say, creative turbulence. Can you kind of briefly summarize just that kind of complicated aspect of the story of this series?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we've come to learn through the last 5 years, but in particularly in the last year, is that this was a workplace environment in which not everybody felt safe at all times. Not everyone felt valued at all times. One thing that I learned throughout so many of these interviews was that despite the fact that this show is so beloved, a lot of the people working on it have a fraught memory of the working environment on the show. And so one thing I sought to unpack was to learn more about why that was. But I also, it created a sensitivity that I started to understand more and more around how one might feel if the thing that they're best recognized for, you know, for decades after the fact, comes with a lot of emotional baggage. And so that's one thing that I tried to explore in this piece. Again, in addition to telling the story of the show, was the story of the behind the scenes aspect of the show. And there's, you know, a number of allegations against the creator of this show from various cast members and crew members alike, who speak about experiences on this show that really stay with them to this day. And I think that they spoke out in the hope of sort of changing the industry as a whole and not allowing figures like this to you know, run shows or sets, you know, in this way, in the hope of eradicating this sort of behavior.
Right. We'll dig into some of that in just a little bit. When you talk about the fandom that surrounds this show, and the fans of this show are really kind of a special breed of themselves. You write at one point, few fans are as big, as vocal, or as committed as fans of Buffy. And as you examine all of this, one of the things you say that comes up again and again when one hears from the most devoted fans to this show is the phrase, the four words, "You saved my life." That is what a lot of fans will say about this television program. Explain that kind of devotion and impact, because this is also something that is true for you. I mean, you have also said that about this program, that in some ways it saved your life.
Right. I mean, I think for a lot of people growing up in the 90s and the early 2000s, there was, you know, less avenues with which to find representation of yourself on television. And particularly for LGBTQ plus people, the landscape was minimal and often could be relegated to caricatures. You know, I think about Will and Grace, for instance. It's like, I was a gay kid growing up. I didn't relate to Will or Jack. I was neither of those two things, and being gay is not so either or. There's lots of nuance. And I think Buffy did a great job for a lot of people, and not just queer people. I think just people who felt like outsiders in any way, and that can come from a number of ways, whether it be self-inflicted or just through their circumstances that they were born into. I think Buffy made a lot of people feel seen, feel accepted, and it really celebrated outsiderness in a way that I still don't think there's a lot of shows that do it quite with quite as much finesse. But it also just showed the fact that, you know, the outsider can not only be okay, they can thrive and they can succeed and they can find other outsiders with which to build a community. That was always the lesson that I took away from the show.
At one point when you talk about this, about the queerness of Buffy, you write that the series created a world where queerness was not othered in quotation marks. Just summarize how the show managed to do that. I mean, in what way were we seeing queerness on the screen in a way that we just hadn't seen it before?
Well, I think, I mean, yes, there were a number of LGBTQ plus characters, which is the more obvious answer, but I think one particularly resonant aspect for me growing up was the idea that, like, there's a lot of queerness in the character of Buffy, and that's not through her sexuality. Buffy is heterosexual, but through the fact that she has this secret that she has to hold on to, that she can't tell anybody else. And I think a lot of queer people, especially young queer people, can relate to that feeling. In addition to that, there's a moment in the season finale of season 2 where Buffy has to come out to her mother as a Slayer. And, I mean, I talk about this at length in the book, even with some of the gay writers on the show, but, like, there is an obvious parallel there to a teen's coming out to their parents. And even Buffy's mom's reaction, she says, "Have you ever tried not being a Slayer?" That's something I think a lot of queer people can relate to in hearing from a parent or in someone that they came out to, this idea of the other person being so caught off guard, wishing that maybe they weren't that way because maybe life wouldn't be so hard. So I always go back to that coming out moment as being one of the queerest moments on the show, despite the fact that it's not intrinsically queer.
Hmm. We need to talk about Joss Whedon, and we need to talk about the very, very serious allegations about the way he treated at least many of members of the cast and the very toxic work environment that he is alleged to have created. But before we talk about that, I want to give you a chance to say something positive about Joss Whedon and the extent to which we really should be thinking about him as a genius who really created something extraordinary, and how much of the success of Buffy the Vampire Slayer belongs to him.
That's a tricky question. I think that there are people out there that are going to read everything about Joss Whedon and say, I can no longer watch Buffy. This taints my viewing experience entirely. And that's perfectly valid. It's something that I brought that voice, those voices into this book. But there are others that are going to say, I cannot separate the memories or the impact that this show has had despite learning the new information that I now know. And for me, I can't deny the fact that Joss's handprints are all over this show. I interviewed one of the writers, Jane Espenson, and I brought up a line of dialogue from one of my favorite episodes. And I was like, this is just some of my favorite, you know, back and forth, you know, one of my favorite back and forths on the show. And she said, oh, that was a Joss rewrite. Joss came in, even though that's my episode, Joss came in and he wrote that line that you're quoting to me now. And that to me was just such an example of the fact that even when you try to seek out aspects of this show that aren't directly Joss's, more often than not, they are Joss's. And I think it's just, it cannot be denied, his work on the show, the greatness of it, the uniqueness of it. He wrote a musical on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. He had never written music or lyrics or any of that before. And he went away one summer between seasons 5 and season 6 and said, you know what? Let's have a musical episode of Buffy. He just, that's the way his brain works. And I still, to this day, in spite of all that I know about him, I marvel at this series that he created.
One way in which the way he mistreated the women on the series, or many of them at least, one sort of capsule summary of it is that Joss Whedon was the stereotypical high school nerd who couldn't get the girl. And so once he achieved some success and a lot of power, he misused that power by, in a sense, kind of lashing out at those sort of pretty young girls that wouldn't have given him a glance when he was back in high school. I think you suggest that this is a simplistic way to understand about what was going on and, if these allegations are true, why he behaved in this way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's hard to diagnose from a psychological perspective for two reasons. One, I don't know these people, so I think that's the most obvious. And two, I wasn't there. So everything that I'm hearing about this is third party. It was really important that I express that throughout the book, that yes, I am giving an oral history, and I'm building said oral history through conversations with people, but various people can have various agendas and or memory lapses. Again, we're talking about a show that began filming 25 years ago at this point. So it was my job to sort of collect as much information as possible, contextualize it as much as I could, and allow people to feel how they're going to feel or distinguish how they are going to feel about this based off of all that they know. Again, going back, I can't tell anyone how to feel about Joss or this show now. What I can do, and what I feel is my due diligence as a journalist and the author of this book, is talk to as many people as possible who were there to gain their perspectives and get a better sense of the overall. But again, it's hard to know what went on because I wasn't there, and there's no direct record of this. But everything I gathered made me have a sense that this was a very fraught working environment.
Right. You did reach out to Joss Whedon in an email, which you share with us in the book, hoping to speak with him, promising him a fair hearing. He never responded. I have not followed his career very closely. Can I assume that his professional career is at something of a standstill at the moment because of all this controversy that has engulfed him?
It's interesting. Standstill is definitely the word that I would use. Since writing the book, Joss actually did an interview about a month or two ago in New York Magazine, where he broke his silence for the first time and spoke of the allegations. But as far as work on the docket, he has nothing currently lined up. But, you know, anyone who sort of follows the machinations of Hollywood would maybe suggest that the fact that he went and did this interview is a signal that he's planning some sort of comeback. There's nothing currently on his docket on, you know, the Internet Movie Database at the moment, but I have to believe that Joss Whedon's Hollywood career is not over. And if you look at, you know, someone like Woody Allen, for instance, those allegations against him did not stop him from continuing a film career. So I think there's great precedent to believe that Joss's career will continue. I know some people will feel some kind of way about that, but I just think that's the reality of the Hollywood industrial complex.
Right. I do want to say I really appreciate and admire the way that you've handled this matter in your book, and you spend a lot of time with it, and you also help us kind of understand how complicated it is when, for instance, people in the cast who did not experience this directly weigh in, trying to be supportive of their colleagues, but sometimes saying not enough, for people feel like they wish they would go further and so on. I mean, it's a very, very complicated situation and fascinating to examine. I want to ask you about something else, which sometimes leads people to criticize the show, and that is its whiteness. The fact that I think you tell us at one point among the 12 main cast members of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, no people of color at all. And now, at least in kind of 2022, that seems pretty outrageous. At the time, did anybody take notice of that?
They didn't. And both on the show and critics of the show, it just wasn't, we weren't having those same conversations that we're having now. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that if the show were to be done today, I think there's a number of things that would be handled very differently. But I think that's the one that stands out to me the most. Both the fact that the lack of POC actors on the show, but also the fact that it was an all-white writer's room. So, you know, besides the on-camera talent being tremendously white, it also happened behind the scenes as well. And I think that's something that people would not only be more conscious of today, but would be more suspect of and would call out more. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of negatives we can say about social media and sort of the discourse that happens on it. But I think one of the positives is in a situation like this, we've seen many instances of a lack of diversity, whether it be race or gender or sexuality, being called out on platforms like social media and films or television shows reacting by changing as a result. I mean, just think about the Oscars So White campaign as a great example. So I would be very curious how this show would be handled today in the modern society that we're living in that holds more accountability to the film and television landscape.
Right. And of course, Buffy is far from alone. I mean, you can look at all kinds of shows.
Absolutely.
From Friends to Cheers to all kinds of others where there was a drastic falling short when it came to having a cast that is truly reflective of the world in which we live.
That's why I tried to really frame it as being, you know, a symptom of the time. Obviously, it's like I don't want to not hold it accountable, as I think I tried to. You know, I think it's worth meditating on, but I think it's important, again, context here, as you just said, to say it was not an outlier in that sense. That was the television landscape, and thankfully, we turned a corner, but that was, you know, that was a time, and it wasn't that long ago.
I want to end on a positive note. I have actually not watched very much of this series, despite my brother-in-law's devotion to it and his encouragement. I did ultimately seek out an episode. The first thing I ever saw was the episode called Hush. That is one of the most extraordinary things I have ever seen. And from what critics say, I began at the top with one of the very finest episodes from this series. If you were going to direct someone who's never explored Buffy the Vampire Slayer to experience this show, where would you have them begin?
I think that you made a really smart choice in going from the very beginning, going from Hush. I'm a completist by nature, so I always like going to the beginning. But like I said, I think you made a good decision in sort of seeking out one of the more famous episodes. So in going with that, I would advise people to go to season 5, the 16th episode. It's called The Body. It's a very famous episode in which someone close to Buffy passes away, and it's one of the few episodes that does not have a supernatural element at its core. And I think that Joss was very responsive to the criticisms of the show, or things that people would say about, oh, the show leans too hard on this or that, and he would sort of respond appropriately. You spoke of the episode Hush, which is a silent episode. That was in response to critics saying, oh, this is a show that it has great dialogue, but that's all it's good for. So Joss was like, oh, that's all it's good for? I'm going to take out the dialogue. And so The Body, this episode that I mentioned, is one of those episodes that removed the supernatural because it was like a crutch that some saw the show having and said, well, what if we remove that crutch? What then? And the result is one of the finest hours of television that I think has ever aired. But like I said, I'm a big completist, so I would say season one, episode one is a good starting point. But if not, The Body or Hush are great entries as well.
I like how you say the first season set the table, and then the second season began serving the meal. And a delicious meal indeed it is. The book, again, is Into Every Generation, A Slayer is Born, How Buffy Staked Our Hearts, published by Hachette, and the author, Evan Roskatz. Evan Roskatz, I loved your book, and I was so excited to speak with you about it. Thank you so much, and best wishes.
Thank you. You as well.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And now, in honor of the 75th anniversary of Walt Disney Studios, here is something from the archives. And in this portion of the Friday Morning Show, I am delighted to be speaking with a Disney fan and journalist by the name of Bruce Steele, who has helped put together a marvelous new book called One Day at Disney: Meet the People Who Make the Magic Across the Globe. This is a book in which we, in a sense, experience Disney all around the globe through the course of essentially a single day. And we're going to be talking with Bruce Steele for the next few minutes about what it took to assemble all of this wonderful information, all of these marvelous photographs, and what people are going to experience themselves if they take this book in hand. Again, the book is titled One Day at Disney: Meet the People Who Make the Magic Across the Globe. Bruce Steele, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So tell us, first of all, a little bit about what is behind those words, Disney fan. What has been your relationship to the world of Disney over the years?
Well, I mean, I grew up as a Disney fan, watching all the Disney movies. I remember being so happy when I'm old enough to remember when VHS tapes first came out, and then you could get your favorite Disney movies and watch them over and over again. And then in the 1990s, my husband was actually a Disney animator. So we had that magic silver pass that lets you go down to the theme park anytime you want and take guests. We lived in Los Angeles, and so we could go down to Disneyland and Anaheim as many times as we wanted. So I can't tell you how many times I've been there.
I wonder what particular projects your husband worked on. I mean, would these be things that we have seen, or was he an animator in a sense in more behind-the-scenes fashion?
No, he worked for 4 years on a Disney animation feature called Dinosaur that came out in the year 2000.
Very good. You know, your account reminds me of very close family members that I have who are at Disney all the time. I mean, repeatedly, year after year after year, they absolutely love it. And they aren't growing tired of it. And I think some people from the outside looking in would imagine that at some point the spell begins to wear off. And yet, at least for some people, that really does not seem to be the case, and it doesn't sound like it's at all the case with you. Explain kind of the lasting power that the Disney experience has on a lot of people, and I think that's a good segue into this beautiful book.
Well, I would compare it to, in Peter Pan, when they leave London and go to Neverland, and it's just, this beautiful, idyllic place with some pirates, but it's a place that you can just revisit and sort of leave the world behind and enter a world that's perfectly made and perfectly displayed and fully entertaining and colorful, and then it's both always the same and yet always different.
I guess that's the part that sometimes people who are really not Disney people, so to speak, maybe don't kind of appreciate, or that sense of sameness is all that they maybe understand or all that they notice, and maybe not fully appreciating all of the ways in which Disney perpetually remakes itself, reshapes itself over the years. And I'm sure, as someone who's been such a frequent visitor to various theme parks, you've seen that up close.
Well, yeah, and to tie it to the book, we talked to about a dozen different people in the Imagineering department, and the Imagineering division of Disney are the people who think up everything that goes into the theme parks, from the decorations that you see on the street to the very elaborate rides that they come up with that everybody loves. And they are, you know, they're constantly at work and constantly creating new things. One of the things that's a big part of the book is the creation of Galaxy's Edge, the new Star Wars immersive Star Wars land that's at Disneyland and Walt Disney World. So yeah, they're at work all the time creating new experiences.
Not sitting on their laurels at all. So let's talk more specifically about this book and what an ambitious project it was. First of all, whose idea was it, this idea of following, in a sense, the worldwide world of Disney through the course of a single day? Whose idea or concept was that?
Well, it actually goes to Bob Iger, who was the CEO of the company. I mean, as part of his job as CEO, he goes all over the world and meets all of these people who work for Disney in all these different capacities, and he thought it would be really interesting to show people who love Disney all of the different jobs that go into the creation of, well, what we call the magic of Disney.
And, of course, not just, for instance, Disney World, which is maybe what most Americans know most intimately, but Disney as it is experienced across the globe. So, for instance, when we open up the book, where are we first?
Well, the first stop is actually Walt Disney World with a young woman named Stephanie Carroll, who is a ranch hand. But one of the interesting things about the jobs in this book is Disney takes ordinary jobs like ranch hand and makes them sort of magical and wonderful. And although her main job is to take care of the horses and to guide people on trail rides, she also gets to dress up in the magical coachman outfit from Cinderella and drive the Cinderella coach with a team of six white horses that are used for what they call fairy tale weddings. You can hire out the Cinderella coach as part of your wedding for wedding photos and for a wedding experience. And also the Cinderella coach, of course, appears in the parades at Walt Disney World. So not only is Stephanie Carroll taking care of horses, which she's been doing since she was 8 years old, she also gets to be a character in this story.
Hmm. And so Disney takes care to make sure that people that might even have what at a glance would seem like a rather mundane sort of position or responsibility, they see to it that even those kind of jobs have a little bit of magic sprinkled into them, so to speak.
Well, sure. I mean, take, for example, the security guard there's two security guards in the book. One of them is at the Disney Studios, and of course, you would think security guard would be sort of a boring job, but he's the guy who, you know, gets to talk to Chris Pratt and Keanu Reeves and all these people that come in and out of the Disney Studios. The other security guard is at Walt Disney World, a guy named Pete Dufour, who is another Army veteran. There's several in the book, and Pete gets to run what they call the flag retreat ceremony every day at 4:30 when they take the American flag down at the plaza at the end of Main Street USA and retire it for the day. And every day they pick out of the guests who are coming into the park, just randomly select somebody who was a veteran, a United States veteran, and have that veteran participate in the flag retreat ceremony. And they honor that veteran's service every day, a different veteran. So even these really jobs that you would think would be uninteresting have really interesting elements to them.
Lovely. We're speaking with Bruce C. Steele about the book that he helped put together titled One Day at Disney, Meet the People Who Make the Magic Across the Globe. I do want to make sure we spread our gaze on sort of an international level, but I do want to have you explain to our listeners how much of the United States we see in this book. I mean, a lot of people, of course, know all about Disney World, and a lot of people know about Disneyland, which came before it, that are sort of on each of the coasts. But you don't settle for just those two locations. Explain to our listeners some of the other places right here in the United States that you also take us to in this book.
Well, of course, Lucasfilm, that creates all the Star Wars movies and experiences, is located in the Bay Area, as is Pixar up around San Francisco. So we spend a lot of time in the San Francisco area. ESPN is headquartered in Bristol, Connecticut. So we also have to go to Bristol, Connecticut. Have to go to New York City to talk to Robin Roberts from Good Morning America and David Muir from ABC World News Tonight. And, of course, then we go to the theme parks in Orlando and Anaheim. And I'm probably leaving some out, but that's a good sample.
So that reminds us, of course, that Disney is not just the things that are emblazoned with those Mickey Mouse ears or whatever other logos we associate with Walt Disney himself and Disney itself, but also some of the properties that Disney owns and operates, and that's a considerable list.
It is a considerable list. It's Pixar and Lucasfilm and ESPN and ABC and Adventures by Disney and Broadway shows. There's a lot going on.
So take us beyond the borders of the United States, because, of course, that's part of what is really wonderful about this book. We don't even have time, of course, to go through the entire list, but tell us some of the places outside of the United States that your book takes us.
Well, of course, we have to go to the Shanghai Disneyland Resort and Hong Kong Disneyland and Disneyland in Tokyo. My favorite story about the Asian properties is it was very difficult for me to set up interviews with the folks in Asia, because when they're going to bed, it's about the time we're getting up in the morning.
Right.
So I finally had to get up really early in the morning to talk to a woman who is a stage manager for the parades at Tokyo Disneyland. And I talked to her at 7 o'clock my time in Asheville, North Carolina. And about 15 minutes into the interview, there was some this noise on the line, like, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And they said, oh, the fireworks have just started here. So 7:15 in the morning on the East Coast in Japan, they're wrapping up the day with the fireworks at Disneyland Tokyo. And I just thought that was an amazing example of the scope of Disney and how there's always something going on 24 hours a day somewhere in the world.
Right. One of the things that Disney fans will especially appreciate is that you take us behind some of those cast members only doors where a lot of the magic is actually created away from the public eye. What kind of access were you given, and what did you think about in terms of what would be most interesting to share with the public? And maybe some of those decisions weren't even entirely yours to make.
No, the cast members were indeed selected before I came on board the project. That was a process that took more than a year, and I came on for the last year of the project to do the interviews and the writing. My favorite behind the cast members visit for myself was I was in Walt Disney World, and I got to go to what is called the Holiday Services Warehouse, and it is exactly what it sounds like. It is a huge warehouse. It is bigger than any Costco you can imagine, and there is nothing in there except holiday decorations, 50-foot trees, tiny little trinkets, entire rows of nothing but Santa heads and reindeer and all this stuff. And then in the back of the warehouse is an area that looks like an auto service kind of facility, except instead of servicing autos, they're servicing holiday decorations. So in place of an automobile brought up on a lift, they've got garland hanging there in front of them, and they're fixing up the garland for the holidays. And these people work at this 365 days a year, and you wouldn't even think of it unless you're reading something like One Day at Disney.
Hmm. Sometimes when we examine things that kind of have an aura of magic about it, sometimes when we examine things more closely, the magic begins to dissipate a little bit. I get the sense from the way you're talking that this has not had that effect at all on you. If anything, you appreciate the magic of Disney even more deeply now.
I think figuring out how the magic works just makes it more magical, because there is all this work and energy and planning and scheming and testing. I can't tell you how many times they have to test out the rides that they put together for the theme parks before they even get to the part where they're building it. And then there's a magical leap in between the technology and the nuts and bolts and the actual experience that is just sort of inexplicable. And I think knowing everything that goes on before you get to the experience just makes that experience all the more fascinating.
Hmm. Bruce Steele, the book is One Day at Disney. Meet the people who make the magic across the globe. Thank you so much. Best wishes.
Thank you.